Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. This is episode 224. My name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. Our featured conversation this week is with Ryan Monkman of Fieldbird Cider, based in Ontario, Canada. Ryan has been kind enough to answer a series of questions from listeners, and we've been breaking it down into a four-part quarantine quad series. So if you want to catch up with us, you might want to go to episode 220, which is part one of the series. And yes, it is a quarantine quad series because we are in a worldwide pandemic. So what better thing to do than to escape away with me now into Ciderville. An episode ago, I introduced a new segment that I am going to be adding into the show, and it's called Stories in Ciderville. It won't always run, but as this grows, it may become more regular. I don't know. It's just we're trying something here, Ciderville. And what this is an opportunity for writers to submit an essay that will then be read by the author on the podcast during a particular episode. The essays I originally had stated would be 3,500 words. Well, actually, I'm going to close that down, that window down, and have it be only 3,000 words. And I'm doing this because I myself had submitted an essay to a public radio station a number of years ago, and it was the requirement then to be 3,000 words, which I find is like the perfect amount of time to read a full essay. So it takes a little bit of skill, keep it flowing, and make it easy to read. So this is, again, the terms. 3,000 words submitted to me, Rhea@ciderchat.com. It could be fiction or nonfiction. If it is technical, too technical, we won't be able to run with that, I'm sorry to say, because this is really about stories, not necessarily a lesson on how to graft a tree. Although you might have a story there about grafting a tree, we're not looking about the technical aspect for this. So I really want to encourage you to have a bit of fun. Try your hand at writing up a story and sharing it. And remember, if it is selected, you will then be recorded reading your story. Now, I'm psyched for this, and I got a lot of folks who have contacted me, and they're all asking me the following questions. Is there a deadline? Well, originally I said, you know, there is no deadline, but I think it's probably good for Ciderville to have a deadline. So we're going to be looking at the end of June. June 25th is the deadline to submit the first segment for Stories in Ciderville. So again, get your pen out and start writing. Again, 3,000 words. It could be fiction or nonfiction. Where you are looking for a story, submit your essay to Rhea@ciderchat.com.
Walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh, I'm excited to announce that there's a new patron for Cider Chat. His name is Luke, and he writes, "Hey, Rhea, I just wanted to say thank you so much for everything that you've done with this podcast. It takes an incredible amount of work to produce a show, and the content you offer is flat out inspiring. Aww. I found your podcast on Spotify last summer when my neighbors offered up extra apples to press, and within a few months, I caught up to your latest episode." A few months, Luke, I mean, that's amazing. But I see how he was able to do it. They live on acreage in north central Iowa, and I spent a lot of time mowing and maintaining our 8-acre homestead. We have planted a small orchard of 22 fruit trees, peach, pear, cherry, etc., and 6 apple trees, and have since planted 28 more apples. So 34 in total, 34 in total, and 17 different varieties. He continues with, "Please keep doing what you're doing, and thank you for all the extra content. I'm just happy to support. I should have done this last year right away." and you're an amazing resource for Started Going Up. Oh, that just like fills my cup so much, Luke. Thank you so much. I love knowing who's out in Iowa listening to Cider Chat and growing apples and making cider. That's freaking awesome. And you know, you too, if you're out there in Ciderville and you've been thinking, oh, I like Cider Chat, you know, I'd love to like, you know, kind of tip the podcaster. Well, you could be like Luke and do that. Just go to the Cider Chat Patreon page. It's spelled Patreon. One more note before we head to our future chat, and that is a reminder to check out the England Cider Tour that is still scheduled for September 1st through the 6th of this year. Yes, we're going to England, to West Country, to both Somerset and Herefordshire. And we're spending like 2 nights at one hotel and like 3 nights at another hotel. And we're not moving around a lot. We're just digging deep into the scene there. And drinking a hell of a lot of cider. I mean, we're looking at like over like 30 different makers, because one part of that is going to the Ross Cider Fest, where everybody shows up who's a cider maker. And, you know, they're in the know there. They're definitely in the know. So it's an amazing tour. Check it out at the Totally Cider page at ciderchat.com. Totally refundable and with all considerations for the pandemic ahead. I'll be keeping this open up to July. Next up is part 4 of the Ask Ryan Quarantine Quad series. And we're going to go right into where I led off last week in part 3, where I was just beginning to talk about a conversation I had with the fine makers at Art and Science. And that is none other than Kim Hamblin and Dan Rinke. I will post a link in the show notes to that conversation, or you could just Google it, Art and Science Cider Chat, and it should come up that way. But regardless, we were talking about a whole bunch of stuff and drinking their amazing cider. I really want to recommend their cider and their artwork and just cool people. We were talking about a number of things, and one particular piece was on film yeast. So we're going to go into that segment now and this conversation with Ryan Monkman of Fieldbird Cider, based in Ontario, Canada. So when, again, going back to like that Art and Science conversation with Dan and Kim, they mentioned that sometimes it can actually protect film yeast, which is, it looks like a layer of kind of, oh, sometimes it could be bubbly.
Yeah, there's different kinds. So if people are trying to identify it, the first thing you'll see is what we call an oil slick. So you'll look at the cider one day and you'll see it kind of looks like someone put a teaspoon of oil in there. Like there's a bit of a shimmer. Mm-hmm. And then from that, yeah, there's, depending on what it is, it can go white and bubbly, or it can just kind of go like white and flaky, and all manner of different things. Depending on the style of cider, yeah, it can be a protectorant. It is an oxygen scavenger. So your film yeast will chew up oxygen. But it's chewing up oxygen to make babies. Mm. So, if it's short term, it can add some protectorant value, but if it goes on for more than a couple weeks, you will see significant loss of aromatics. Cause it does tend to be spoilage. Mm-hmm. Trillion different things film yeast can be, but typically it's one of two things. So the first thing is regular yeast that you use to ferment, if still alive and finds its way to the surface and finds air, will form that surface scum. That is the kind that can offer that short-term protection a little bit. Mm-hmm. It will, with time, because it's pulling oxygen in and making babies and pulling more oxygen in and making babies. And that process will start chewing away at aromatics. So that is the one that can be in the short term kind of beneficial, but in the long term, I would say generally negative. The second kind of film yeast, which actually isn't a yeast, it's a bacteria, is Acetobacter. So acetobacter is what forms vinegar. So acetobacter, in the presence of oxygen, will create acetic acid. So that is something that you want to get rid of as soon as you can. So there's two ways that we manage film yeast, or it's also called flor, F-L-O-R, when it forms in barrels, and it happens commonly. The first thing we do is we slowly overtop. So film yeast by itself will float. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. So rather than top quickly, we'll very slowly, and oftentimes with like a hose into the barrel, mm-hmm. add more cider until what ends up happening is the scum, if you will, floats out up through the bunghole, down the side of the barrel onto the ground. Mm-hmm. And we'll do that a couple of times over the course of about a week to try and decrease the population as much as we can. And then that barrel, rather than get topped up every 2 to 3 weeks, which is our normal protocol, mm-hmm. will get topped up every week and fully sealed. And we'll get kind of extra attention just to make sure that's not getting out of control. That's one way we deal with it. If we have a persistent problem, we do something called a bottom rack. So think of when you rack off of a carboy, how you take everything from the top and you leave the bottom behind. Mm-hmm. So we do the opposite. We stick a hose or a barrel wand right to the bottom of the barrel. So we're sucking out the lees first. Mm-hmm. And we take everything except for the top like inch. And we leave that behind. Because that's kind of where the problem is.
Yeah.
So those are the two ways that we use to manage it. It's something when we notice it, we respond quickly because we're worried about either acetobacter growth or we're worried about loss of aromatics. Because one of the things that we kind of pride ourselves on is how aromatically strong our profiles are. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why it's a big deal to us.
But the Ryan. Let me just ask a question. But the cider could still taste good. It might not have the aromatics. So if you end up, as I have with that, and I'm going to do what you're talking about, I was going to plunge into it and suck up from the bottom up. You can then blend in a very aromatic, like I have a lot of quince right now that I might throw in there to kind of kick up the aromatics if it hasn't gone to that acetobacter, you know.
And 9 out of 10 times the cider is actually perfectly fine. It's not impacted. It's only like the top like inch or two. Like if you pull a sample from the top inch and then you pull a sample from like the body, you'll notice a substantial change in flavor. Like, so usually the bottom racking just solves the problem and you still have a great cider.
But if it's a still cider, you're going to have that film in the bottle.
Not necessarily. Okay. So the film needs a good amount of oxygen to exist. And if we bottle without film and we limit the oxygen available, it solves the problem. So there's two approaches we can take. So one is we can do something, if it's unfiltered, we can do a what I'll call a generous bottom rack. So rather than leave an inch, we'll leave like 3 or 4 inches, right? Mm-hmm. Bottle it very quickly and we'll purge our bottles with nitrogen as we're bottling mm-hmm. to limit oxygen in them. We filter some of our ciders. So if you filter it down to what's called sterile filtration, you'll remove the film yeast. It won't exist anymore. It won't be there anymore. Mm-hmm. But filtering is not inherently bad, but it's not right for every cider.
Right. And not all hobbyists like myself, you know, I'm not really filtering my cider. I'm mm-hmm. looking at it, and I also thought about like pushing it you know, putting it in a carboy and then pushing it out of the carboy with CO2 to like decrease the amount of oxygen into, while I'm bottling.
Does it? Yeah, that works well. Okay. The other thing is most of your stuff is, I mean, most of your stuff is bottle conditioned, right?
Yeah.
So that in itself will deal with the issue.
Oh, okay.
But if it is still, that's where the idea of pushing with carbon dioxide is a great solution.
I thought I would just you know,
limit it.
Yeah. Maybe add some bubbles and just kind of hide it.
Yeah, or add a little bit of sulfur at bottling, which binds with oxygen as well. Mm-hmm. So
sure,
like there's lots of ways to manage it. It's not a death sentence by any stretch of the imagination. And like you know, we have dozens of barrels a year that develop some form of floor that, okay. that as long as we're quick to respond to, it's never an issue.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm kind of wondering about. If this is happening regularly, you know, with your barrel, like I went through a big clean last year before I filled it this year, thinking that maybe I dealt with the film from last year, but obviously I haven't. I'm also kind of terrified to move the barrel right now because I know that it will kind of flake off and drop to the bottom. So I'm keeping it as still as possible to rack it out of the barrel into, you know, glass carboys. So I don't get the flakes coming in. Because I was doing batonnage, and I'm like, oh, crap, look at that. I'm filling it, and I'm seeing a film yeast.
Yeah. So that what you're dealing with is likely like regular yeast. Cerevisiae and oxygen good. Together.
Thank goodness. I hope you're right. It doesn't,
you would know if it's acetobacter. Yeah. And acetobacter tends to be like more bubbly. Mm-hmm. As like, you can actually get it tested at, we have, you know, the university lab we can send stuff to for, I think it's like $20 to find out the answer to this mm-hmm. question. But I'm sure there's, a lab near you that you can send it to, but if you're not smelling it, it's not an issue. So, acetic acid it's always going to be there. So apples coming in, like clean apples coming in, like well farmed fruit that doesn't have a lot of rot, is the juice of it has somewhere in the ballpark of 0.1 to 0.2 grams per liter of acetic acid in it. It's already there. When you ferment, you're going to produce some acetic acid as well. It's a byproduct of fermentation. So a very clean ferment, like healthy, no problems at all, it's probably going to finish fermentation somewhere in the ballpark of 0.3 to 0.4 grams per liter of acetic acid. If you're aging your cider, you're gonna increase the acetic acid content because there's acetobacter in there, guaranteed. There's nothing you can do about it. But the trick is to try and manage it. And the best way to manage it is by managing oxygen because it needs oxygen to create acetic acid. But if you age a cider in barrel for a year and it's clean, you're probably coming out of there somewhere in the ballpark of 0.6 grams per liter of acetic acid. And all that is fine because humans can't smell it until it's about 0.8 grams. Hmm. So you will not notice a difference in its acetic acid content from the juice stage to the bottle if you haven't had an infection throughout that whole phase. Mm-hmm. It's not until about 0.8 grams per liter that people can start to smell it. Below that, you can't smell it at all. At about 0.8 grams is when people can start to smell it. Mm-hmm. And it usually doesn't become gross or I shouldn't say gross, but usually it doesn't become an obstacle until you hit about 1 gram or above. So mm-hmm. if you're not smelling it, it's definitely not an issue. And if you start to smell it, just bottle it quickly. Because if you start limiting the oxygen, you'll limit that process.
Bottle and use a little bit of sulfite.
Yeah. So you have time to respond. Mm-hmm. You're not going to wake up one morning and your cider's ruined.
You know, I have heard stories of people kind of freaking out like that, like, you know, especially like with Perry And all of a sudden it's like, oh my goodness, is that really starting to smell off there? And you know what to do. So does Perry differ in that way from the apples?
Not an acetic acid. I mean, the pears coming in start at a higher level of acetic acid, but it's still similar. You're not smelling it until at least 0.8, 0.75, 0.8 grams per liter. And then you still have time to respond. Pears tend to have higher levels of acetic acid after fermentation, just because fermenting, like a pear ferment, is more stressful than an apple ferment for the yeast. Mm-hmm. But you, as long as you're regularly tasting and regularly smelling your cider, you should be able to spot a problem before it becomes a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least in the Acetobacter front. There are other things that can just show up out of nowhere, which are infuriating, but Acetobacter, like acetic acid, you're gonna start to smell it before it becomes a problem.
And this is a problem. It happens to, like, you know, good cider makers sometimes. I've gotten off bottles from, you know.
And you know, sometimes it happens with us too, right? We're equipped. I've trained and studied for years. My coworker also went to winemaking school. And like we taste every single barrel at least once every 2 weeks, and we get barrels that come up with acetic acid, and we have the luxury of one, we can test for it. At Fieldbird, it happens to us too. Sometimes we get creeping acetic acid, and that's a result of aging stuff in barrel for a long period of time and putting a lot of our stuff through malolactic fermentation. So a lot of our cider is, you know, quote, unprotected by anything other than topping for months. And we get acetic acid sometimes. We regularly taste everything. So everything in the cellar gets tasted at least once every 2 weeks. If it's something we're worried about, it gets tasted every week. If it's something we're really worried about, it gets tasted every couple days. Mm-hmm. When we sense something at threshold, we come up with a plan to respond to it. But we have the ability that a lot of home places don't, which is if we have 5 barrels of Northern Spy and only one of them just hit threshold, we can blend the 5 together and it'll be back below threshold. Mm-hmm. Right? So if we have 4 barrels at 0.5 grams and 1 barrel at 0.8, when we blend them together, it's going to be like 0.55. That's an advantage we have that someone who's making 1 or 2 carboys a year doesn't have. But the key thing I would say is you like cider anyways, so just make sure you're tasting all the time.
Right, exactly. Not a hard job to do.
Yeah, it's the best part.
Yeah, don't tuck those carboys, if you're like me, like in the way back corner. Have them out and accessible. And I think that's also true, like you were getting to with the barrels of stacking it. Think about how high you got to climb, and is that going to be a deterrent to you then managing the barrels as time goes on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, like the best advice, whether it's barrels or anything else, is just taste regularly. Because if you know... It's like anything. If you're tracking it, you know what's going on with it. You'll sense a problem before it's an actual problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great. Well, I want to go on to these couple questions from Aiden at Berg By on Instagram.
Oh, Adrian.
I'm sorry. Okay. Adrian. Yes. And you know this fellow here. I guess he's in the wine world, but I think he has some really good questions that I've kind of wondered myself too, Ryan, because you do have very unique ciders that are in that wine style. And so he was asking, can you explain the different process that you use to make these wonderful, almost wine-like ciders?
That's a tough question. What I'll say is I really like Adrian. He's a huge booster of Ontario wine and Ontario cider. And is a supporter of us and is a supporter of at least 50 other places, which is truly remarkable. Mm. what do we do? We guide ourselves in the cellar on kind of two overarching rules. So the first rule we have is we don't use adjuvants. So not that that's like stuff like cherries or lemon peel, or not that those things are bad, because they're not. And a lot of the cider I drink has adjuvants in it. But it was a challenge for us to say, we're going to not allow ourselves to use that. So it forces us to use technique in different ways. And the other rule that we have is that, so there's the no adjuvants, as well as we have to explore technique, and everything touches oak. So whether that is something that maybe only ferments in oak and then gets quickly pulled out, or something that ages in oak for, you know, we have Northern Spire right now that's been aging for 2 years. But everything has to touch oak at some point in its process. Mm-hmm. And that boxes us in to a narrow world of possibility, which, because it does that, we have to find ways of creating different ciders using only technique. So we have good fruit to work with. We have our own orchard, which we're transitioning to biodynamics. I think it's producing really good fruit, so that helps a lot. And then we use technique, but all the techniques we know how to use are from the wine world, because that's how I study, and that's how my colleague Amelia studied. Mm-hmm. So we're, the blunt answer is, why is our cider wine-like? It's because that's what we know how to do.
But there's something different and unique about your cider. And I often, you know, think about what you're doing. And then when I see what, like, Eric Bordelais does, and he brings out a certain kind of fruit forward profile in all his ciders. And they are not like your classic. They're in a world of their own. And there's only a few makers in the world, like yourself and Eric, that are really producing this amazing fruit forward that isn't, it's wine-like, but it's not. It's still cider. So I'm wondering, is there like certain filtrations, or you're just doing it? I mean, I know how you're doing it. You're just going straight with the barrel, but you're really managing it like a wine.
Yeah, I keep referencing Amelia, because Amelia, as we've grown Fieldbird in the last few years, Amelia is helping with the cider making. We also have a cellar hand. Her name is Mel. So it's the three of us who kind of run the cider making side of the business, which is a lot different from how we started 3 years ago, when it was just me renting space in my buddy's winery. Mm. But kind of our approach is still the same. One of the things we try to do is what we call build complexity. So we don't want people just to have one flavor or one smell in each of our ciders. We don't want this cider to smell like passion fruit and this one to smell like Chardonnay or anything like that. We want everything to be as complicated as possible. Complexity is king. Any way we can make it more complicated, we want to do that. So working with barrels gives us a lot of opportunity to do that. So our Northern Spy varietal release each vintage is generally about 5 barrels. And each of those 5 barrels are wholly different from the other ones. So they're all fermented in different styles and at different temperatures, each of them with a goal to form a different piece of the puzzle. So, as an example, in 2019, we had one barrel that we intentionally fermented as we were trying to get it as hot as we possibly could. Our goal was to hit 30 degrees Celsius with it, which is, you have the conversions in front of you, but that.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I could get that up here. 30 degrees is 86.
Yeah, like 86 Fahrenheit. Yep. Really hot for a ferment. Yeast will kill itself from heat at about 35 degrees Celsius, like 95 Fahrenheit, somewhere in that ballpark. So like really riding that line. And how we did that was using a big barrel so it would retain its heat, putting it in a hot spot, and using one of the aquarium heaters that I was talking about. And the idea is that cider, we're basically going to blow off any fruit smells that's in that cider. That cider is not going to have a lot of pretty smells to it. But what it will have is a really active yeast population, which will add massive amounts of body and fattiness to the final product. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, we had another barrel, which we tried to do the exact opposite with. We tried to keep it as cold as possible. The ferment took forever. And we were managing it in such a way that we would extract lots of what are called esters. So really volatile aromatics that are super pretty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other three barrels are treated differently. And then the idea is we have all these different pieces and we age them all separately. And then when it comes time to bottle, at that point, we blend them. And sometimes we blend all of it. Sometimes we blend some from this barrel, all of this barrel or whatever. But we try to build as many puzzle pieces as possible. Mm-hmm. And then we try to find a way to fit them together later. Mm-hmm. So if we can produce, you know, we have 80 active barrels right now and we have some tanks. So we had, I think at the peak of harvest, we had like 110 active ferments at once. And that is crazy management. That's why there's three of us. Because each of those ferments during fermentation gets visited twice a day, minimum. So there's morning checks and there's evening checks, like every 12 hours. And then if something is happening that is going to require intervention, so something maybe needs some nutrition, we exclusively use nutrition that's yeast derived. So like we don't use DAP. Again, I don't. Mm-hmm. If you use DAP, doesn't make it bad. It's just not something we use.
Right.
So if something needs nutrition, now someone's babysitting that barrel. So they have to check it every hour until it's the perfect time to add the nutrition for whatever the goal of that barrel is. Whatever that barrel is trying to tell us it wants to be, our job is to help it do that. Another example is like the fortification. We try to hit our targets as close as possible to what we think would produce the best fortified cider for that barrel. So when it comes time to, we call it crashing a ferment. So when you add brandy to stop the ferment, usually we're doing that at peak fermentation where it's dropping, you know, 4 to 5 bricks a day. And we're trying to hit like right at the peak of the curve. And we're trying to hit within an accuracy of 0.1 brick. Mm-hmm. So in that case, you know, there's been several times where someone has, like usually me, stayed overnight at the cidery during harvest, and every 15 minutes sampling the barrel, stirring and sampling. And when you hit that point, immediately fortifying. Mm-hmm. And I think using techniques like that, I don't think there's a positive word to describe it. And the word I want to use to describe it probably would get you the little E symbol on the podcast.
Well, already have that. Explicit. Yeah, right.
But I think in some ways it's kind of us being a bunch of jackasses. Mm. But our idea is that if we kind of work as hard as we can on every single one of these components for the 2.5-3 months that harvest lasts, when spring comes and we start to decide where things go, which is kind of the process we're just in now, as we're deciding what goes where, we've given ourselves, you know, over 100 different components to work with. And most of those components are varietal. So, you know, we have this many barrels of Golden Russet, this many barrels of Northern Spy. We have this many barrels of apples foraged from the trail near us. We have a huge amount of pears right now. But if we've worked hard during harvest to make sure that every single thing in that cellar is wholly different from everything else, then we have an opportunity to try blending. And blending is where we build that complexity. And I think that blending component is where we start to veer more into the wine territory again.
Yeah. So, and that's those skill unto its own is blending. I mean, you know, how do you even begin to learn blending other than just trial and error and trial and error?
The best thing we do for blending, to be honest, is we find something we think we like, and then we bottle a few bottles and we just like give it to friends of ours and then get them to give their feedback. So you've met Lee Baker, who's like my best friend up here in the county.
Winemaker.
Who's at Redtail Vineyards now in Prince Edward County. Just getting him to try stuff that we make and getting, you know, Batista, who's another winemaker whose opinion I trust. People I know will be honest. And people who have the palates to say, this is really good, but I think you should add another component that has more manna protein. Or this is really good, but I think it's a bit too estery. Maybe back off on your ester barrel a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than using 100% of the ester barrel, maybe we'll only use 85% of it.
Yeah, I think that the fact that you do have such a knowledge base from the wine industry has helped you really move forward at Field Bird at a level that a lot of makers don't necessarily have, because they're taking it from the classic approach that's been done in, I'm going to use the U.S. for instance, in the stainless, even though history, you know, is with the barrels. So it's kind of a relearning. But the barrels that were used long ago, the cider makers around here, they would just be throwing in different spirits to probably stabilize the barrel, but it wasn't necessarily a super well-balanced cider, the, you know, pre-prohibition ciders of long ago. Not that I was around to, like, really taste it, but that's what I'm assuming, because in the early days of cider making here in the U.S., I did taste a lot of those ciders, and they were kind of all over and really boozy ciders because they're all fortified. And that's kind of all that folks have historically, but your winemaking background, I think, really comes in to really create an amazing profile coming out of all your ciders. And that's what Adrian's talking about.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. That's a really kind thing to say.
Well, it's true. Let's go to this other question from Adrian, which I'd like to know too. How did you get started and fall in love with cider?
I don't really know the full answer to that. There's a couple of things. So one, before we owned a cidery, one of my jobs was as a researcher in cider development. So developing cider profiles for a couple major brands that were entirely market driven. And while that was a really interesting experience, and I certainly learned a lot from it, I also recognized that the market for cider, at least in Canada, did have a big gaping hole in it, which was coincidentally the kind of ciders that Nicole and I like to drink, which is, you've talked about Airport LA. Mm-hmm. And we sometimes, our government alcohol stores will bring in some Poir from Airport LA.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it usually happens in end of May and it's gone in about a week. So like we try to get as much of it as we can as soon as it lands here.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's the kind of stuff that we like to drink. Now you know Eric better than I do. I think his background is a sommelier, correct?
Yeah, definitely a sommelier. He was like a dishwasher that built his, you know, himself up to be a top sommelier in Paris.
Yeah, so I think there's some kinship there. I'm not a sommelier. I studied as a winemaker as opposed to on the tasting and recognition side. But I think there's some connection there in background.
Well, he also was, his best friend was Didier Dagenau, who was renowned for his Sauvignon Blancs in France. And of course, he died tragically in a plane crash in one of those self-propelled planes. But I have a feeling, and Eric's, you know, touchstone is with a lot of folks in the wine world, and that's where his interest is still to this day. So I think he got a lot of nurturing along the way from Didier for his cider making early on.
I mean, you know, I blame you for our increase in Perry, but but I think I would blame Eric Bordelais for us recognizing that cider can be different, can be more wine-like. Mm. And we tend to drink a lot more cider in that vein whenever we can get it. Mm-hmm. So there's this combination of, I was starting to work in the cider world, and also I got exposed to these ciders that just blew my mind away. Mm-hmm. At the same time, my wife Nicole and I were looking to have a biodynamic farm, and biodynamics is I know I've heard it on your show a few times, but just quickly, it's a form of agriculture that starts with the baseline of organic farming and then takes it one step further in that it recognizes a spiritual realm and that animals and plants are connected in this spiritual realm. And it tries to increase biodiversity by accessing the spiritual realm. So a tree is more than a tree, and a tree is happier when it has a friend who isn't a tree. A tree is happier when it has a friend who is a fox or is an understory growth and things like that. And it is possible for us to have a more biodiverse farm if we're using full-size apple and pear trees than if we're using small grapevines. Mm-hmm. And things like, we can have animals underneath them. Like you'll see in Pays d'Auge, it's really common to have cows and sheep in the orchard. Mm-hmm. Which is something we're working toward. And it also allows us to work with the wider spacing in apples and pears than in grapes. Allows us to work more biodiversity into the spaces between. So an example is the tree order that's arriving today that got delayed. None of those are apple or pear trees. They're what we're going to be using for replanting in the orchard, but they're things like tulip trees, other forms of trees that'll be about the same size and have slightly different pollination rhythms. We're replanting right now with trees that are going to have different pollination rhythms. So the goal is in a few years for 30% of our orchard to be things other than apples and pear trees. So increasing biodiversity that way, which has a number of benefits. One is a tulip tree is a disease stop. So if we have a line of apple trees that are spreading some sort of bug or pest that we're having difficulty managing, and we don't want to do that actively manage, it's likely to stop when it hits a tulip tree because it's something that's feeding on apple trees. Mm-hmm. So that tulip tree can protect a whole other line of apple trees for us. The other side of it is these trees we're planting and we're nurturing, they're full-size apple trees. And we expect them to live 100 years, more than 100 years. Mm-hmm. And we don't expect, sadly, the bee population to last that long. So we have to design our orchards to outlive the number one pollinator that orchards use, which is bees. So we have to plan now to start attracting other natural pollinators, again, building biodiversity, but so that 20, 30 years from now, when we've killed all the bees because we're fucking up the whole world, hopefully we can still pollinate our apple trees using other local pollinators. So the how we got into this is there's this confluence of we found cider that we really liked and we wanted to join that world. We have training. I have training as a winemaker. Nicole has training as a horticultural therapist. We wanted the biodynamic farm. And kind of all those things came together that this is what we should be doing. And we toyed around with the idea for a couple of years of like, talking about it as, you know, something we do later. And then when our son Lyndon was born in March 2017, I had only quit my job at a winery in the county like a month before he was born. So I didn't have a job. And being a being a parent is amazing, but being a parent in the first few months is really hard. And at one point I broke down on the phone with my mom. I was saying, sorry, I'm starting to cry thinking about it, but I was just saying, like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. It's like, I have no idea how to be a father. Oh yeah. And like, I don't have a job and I have no idea, you know, we have enough money for a couple of months, but I don't know what we're going to do after that. and my mom actually put me on speakerphone with my dad there. And for the record, I'm 30 years old. I probably shouldn't go to my mother for all of my problems, but I certainly go to her with a lot of them.
That's pretty cool, dude. I mean, that's pretty cool.
My mom asked me, she's like, well, what do you want to do? I was like, I want to just try something creative, and I want Lyndon to see me do it. I want him to see that even if it completely bombs and fails, that was okay too. What the important part was that we tried. My dad just said, okay, do it. And then hung up the phone. So, and we launched Fieldbird, which at the time was just called the Monkman Virtual. Because we didn't have a name for like the first 8 months.
Oh, that's great.
We launched it in May of 2017 is when we started working on it.
That's awesome, Ryan. Thank you.
Okay, we'll talk to you later, Rhea.
Okay, bye-bye, buddy. Oh, that was awesome for me to hear Ryan be able to talk about himself and tell us a bit about his history. I've had such a hard time kind of pinning him down about that. He has a tendency to talk about everybody else except himself. So, dude, we got you. I love it. And if you have a question now, you know, like a cider making question, something comes up, send them my way, because I'm sure we'll be able to do another segment like this again with Ryan called Ask Ryan. And there was a question that came in from the Netherlands. We didn't directly get to that. So maybe I'll follow up with Ryan on that. But that came in from Elchas Distillery. It's south of Amsterdam. And it was from Arjen, the maker there. And I had their cider, by the way. It's very, very good. I want to highly recommend it. The cidery, it has a Dutch name, of course, but it's spelled Elegast. And if you heard me talk or speak kind of like butcher up Dutch in the past, the G is often pronounced as H. So it's the N, E is an A. So it's Elhast Distillery. Delicious distillery. And the question came in, you know, what about storing barrels outside? And I think you might have gotten the answer in all these episodes. So I'm hoping, I'm going to follow up with Ryan and see if he has anything further to say that we didn't cover on that. In the meanwhile, one other piece I wanted to mention, if you want to get your cider analyzed, you know, for that film yeast to understand it further, and you're on the East Coast, then search no further than Process NMR Analysis. They are supporters of this year's podcast. That's John Edwards. He did the episode called Chemical Fingerprints, and he could do an analysis of your cider. So there's a link in the show notes to Process NMR. Well, it's time to roll out of here. I could hear the birds are beckoning me outside with their songs, probably the phoebes making the nest underneath the eaves again. And one more thing to share. A 400-pound bear walked through my yard just a couple days ago. Now, that is something. I'll leave you with that thought. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Cider, we like ponds, we love orchards and having fun. There is a reason,
there is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
like cider. We like palms. We like orchards. Having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this. Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh, yeah.
We like cider.
Oh, yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh, yes, we do.
We love orchards.
Having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
Ba-da-da-dum. We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh, yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh, yes, we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!